Good morning and welcome to everyone. Thank you for being here. Obviously, I can't be here this Sunday. I am at my nephew's wedding right now. And of course, weddings are an important part of the life of our community of believers, no matter where we are, within our families, within our congregations, in the world in general. And so, you know, Jesus celebrated his first miracle at a wedding, and I think every wedding I've ever been to has been a bit of a miracle unto itself. And so I'm pleased and honored to be able to take part in that. But sorry that I can't be with you all this Sunday, especially because this particular passage that we've got for this Sunday is one that's always really intrigued me. Jesus's message is always very immediate. When he calls his disciples to come and follow him, they are in the process of mending the nets in their ships, some of them. And he doesn't say, when you get off work tonight. He doesn't say, when you're done mending your nets. He doesn't say, when you're done putting your equipment away for the day, or even to the point of, well, when you can find some replacements for you on the fishing vessel, come and follow me. No, Jesus says, come and follow me, and they get out of their ships and immediately do so. In today's gospel passage, Jesus is in the process of heading towards Jerusalem. The exact wording that's used here is that he has set his face towards Jerusalem. Now, this isn't that Jesus has never been to Jerusalem before in his life, and he's just kind of excited about making the trip and getting to see the big city. This isn't just that Jesus is going to Jerusalem for religious purposes, to go to the temple to make a sacrifice, maybe to celebrate the Passover, which is, of course, what he is going to do. But that rather specifically, Jesus is going to Jerusalem for the express purpose of making his messiahship known and fulfilling his final purpose in the one and only place that it would really matter, the holy city of Jerusalem. And of course, we get a lot of things sort of happening within this text. Jesus is on his path towards Jerusalem. And while he's on his path, there are still people who are finding his message compelling, who want to hear what it is that he has to say. More importantly, who want to be a part of what it is that he's doing. And it's interesting because up to this point, Jesus has welcomed many people to follow him, but he's also recommended any number of people to not follow him. In repeated fashion, Jesus has done miracles with individuals, and they've said, I really want to come with you to do ministry, and Jesus has sent them on a different path. He said, perhaps go back to your village, tell everyone what has happened. Go back to your family, show them what has happened. Go to the temple priests or to the rabbi at your synagogue and explain what has happened. Multiple occasions, Jesus has found individuals of faith, and he has sent them on a different task. And when I say different, I don't mean an inferior task. Just because these individuals asked to be a part of the cadre of people following Jesus around, and he instead sent them to do something different, doesn't mean that it was any lesser a part of his overall plan, wasn't mean it, that it is any lesser part of the overall development of his ministry. It just means he sent them to do something different. You know, maybe when Jesus encountered these individuals and he says, no, don't follow me. Instead, go back and tell everyone what you've seen. It may be that it's more important to Jesus's ministry in that moment that that part of Galilee or Israel or even the Gentile territories like we had just a few weeks ago are being kept in a place where they're hearing the message. They're experiencing someone's testimony in a way that is setting the stage for the future church. Jesus' plan is so much larger than the immediate group of people following him around. And we see this early in his ministry when Jesus is being surrounded by thousands of people in the Galilean ministry that he is doing. He actually seems to set out to winnow that number down to just a small crowd that's following him. Now, again, the small crowd that's following him is bigger than just the 12 disciples. Obviously, we think of them first because they had a very pivotal role in what he was doing, but we also know that there was a crowd of other disciples that came along, as well as a large group of folks who came to be a support to his ministry, including people like Mary and Martha and Lazarus. And of course, Mary, the mother of Jesus, is oftentimes present in pivotal moments, giving us the impression that she's also traveling with him. Mary Magdalene, there's a lot of Marys in this process. We've got any number of individuals who are with Jesus. So it's not as though he's just wandering the territory with 12 individuals. And it's not that this is an exclusive group that just everyone can't join. But as he's on his way to Jerusalem, he seems particular about those who are welcome to be a part of what he is doing. And of course, part of this is he knows he will not have time to disciple these individuals, to train them, to teach them, to help them mature before they face some extreme circumstances, the most extreme circumstances. And so this isn't an entry-level discipleship position that people are asking for. It would sort of be like if you decided to take up gymnastics this year and go to the Olympics next year. That's not how these things work. So as Jesus is walking across the territory, people are coming to him, and they're either asking to be a part of his ministry, and he is sort of actively putting them off. Now, he's not necessarily welcome everywhere. He goes to a Samaritan town, and there's this great moment in the passage where Jesus goes to the Samaritan town, and they are not welcoming to him, not because of his message, not because he's said something controversial that they disagree with, but because his face is set towards Jerusalem. Now, the principal difference between the Samaritans and the Jews wasn't faith. Wasn't their understanding of God. It wasn't the scripture passages. It was where they understood the proper location of the temple should be. The Jews believed that the temple should be on Temple Mount in Jerusalem. The Samaritans were a different group that believed that the proper temple location was on a Samaritan mountain, and they had their own center of worship. And so they were fundamentally siblings, arguing over what's the right holy city, not arguing over what, you know, the Ten Commandments mean, not arguing over, you know, what did the Exodus experience signify, just arguing over real estate. So when they find out that Jesus is going to Jerusalem to do holy things, they're like, well, why would you do that? That's not the real holy city. And so they don't want to have anything to do with him. But of course, Jesus is going to go on to Jerusalem because, as we know, that really was the correct location for the Temple Mount. But he's encountering these people time and time again who are coming up and saying, please, may I follow you? And Jesus is dismissing them, again, because he's on his way to the Olympics. This isn't time to take up the sport. And he wants to be sure that the people coming to follow know just how serious and significant this endeavor is. And we come across what I've always found one of the most intriguing passages or statements that Jesus ever makes. He's talking to an individual who comes to him and says, I want to follow you. Just let me bury my father first. Not an unreasonable request. But Jesus says this weird thing. He says, let the dead bury the dead. There's an immediacy to what he is doing, to the point that this notion that he can't let this guy pause long enough to do what is understandably an important task, it points to how important what it is that Jesus is going to do in Jerusalem. Now, there are a few ways to understand the passage when Jesus says, let the dead bury the dead. It might be that this individual's father has just died. And as the oldest son, it is your duty as a Jew to be in charge of your father's interment and his burial. It is the specific duty of the older son. That doesn't mean that someone else can't do it, but it changes something. What it changes is inheritance. If you're the oldest son and you shirk your duties to bury your father, Then your inheritance will pass to the next oldest son if they take on that responsibility. To that end, it was considered a fairly common occurrence for individuals to not only be present when their father was going to die, even if you lived far away, you had a farm that was miles and miles and miles away, you heard that your father was dying, you rushed to his side. Maybe, out of love and respect and a genuine desire to be present with your father, but it was just as likely that you wanted to be sure not to miss your chance to bury your father and gain your inheritance. To the point that it was often you would go and wait for your father to die. And even after he died, you might wait for an extended period of time, even up to a year, so that you could demonstrate to everyone that you were the person who was there taking care of your father's estate after he died, even to the very extreme point of waiting a full year after your father had died, digging his bones up, and then reburying them to sort of double check, to make extra sure that everybody knew that you'd done your task, and you'd even checked to make sure that you've done the task and redid it just to be safe. So when this individual comes up to Jesus and says, just let me bury my father and then I will come and follow you, he's indicating that he's got some worldly, probably has some very worldly priorities. That the notion that just let me bury my father in 21st century is definitely different than what let me bury my father in first century would be. For you or for me, if one of our parents died, we would be mourning, we would be sad, we would participate in the funeral planning, we would come to the service, and we would mourn and have our moment. And that would not be indicative of any, for most of us, would not be indicative of any motive other than love and mourning. Now, maybe, I guess, if your parent's worth $1 billion and you want to be sure that you don't get cheated out of your share of inheritance, you might be worried about some clause in the will. But even today, you can miss your father's inheritance, or your father's funeral, and still gain your inheritance unless there's some very specific clauses in their will. But for Jesus, this is a clear example of an individual having a divided loyalty. And then he makes this statement, anyone who puts their hand to the plow and turns back is not worthy of the kingdom of God. The notion there being, you're not going to plow a very straight line if you're looking back instead of looking forward. Your job is to hold that line straight while whatever animal pulls your plow, whether it's an ox or a horse or a donkey or whatever. Your job as the farmer is to keep your hand firmly on the plow, keep that line straight, and make sure that it doesn't, wobble all over the place. If you're busy looking back and saying, how was my line, or what's behind me, or how much further do I have to go? There's a million things that could be distracting you instead of keeping that laser focus on keep the line straight, keep the line straight, keep the line straight. And Jesus's point is, you can't have alternative focuses. And this is something that I think as Christians we really don't hear enough. We don't think about enough. We don't process enough. And that is, there's no such thing as a hyphenated Christian. What do I mean by the fact that there's no such thing as a hyphenated Christian? There is no room in our faith as Christians for anything that draws our attention away from the mission of Jesus Christ. And for that reason, you can't be a liberal Christian. You can't be a conservative Christian. You can't be a progressive Christian. You can't be a traditional Christian. You can't be a contemporary service-only Christian. You can't be a liturgy-only Christian. anything that you would hyphenate that Christian with is a secondary focus. It's a distraction from the primary focus that has to be above and beyond everything else. It to be a liturgy-only Christian or a contemporary service-only Christian is to put your hand to the plow and look back. Because you've got that goal in front of you, which is service to God, that goal in front of you, which is faith in Jesus Christ. And then you've got that priority behind you, which is how am I doing the worship service? Or what are my politics? Or what is the social agenda? What is the value of traditionalism? All of these things, I'm not saying are necessarily bad things. I enjoy a good liturgical worship service, but I also enjoy a good contemporary worship service. I understand that there's some value to liberal philosophies. I understand there's some value to conservative philosophies. But Jesus's point here is you can't be beholden to anything other than him. You can't be in service to anything other than him, especially as he's on his way to Jerusalem where he's going to take up his cross. In this moment, like an Olympian, which I mentioned earlier, you know, they eat, sleep, breathe, drink their sport from as young as at all possible. So if you're going to be an Olympic gymnast, you're also not going to say to yourself, well, I think I might also be an Olympic golfer or an Olympic track star, or maybe I'm going to, you know, take up macrame full time. I don't know. What are you going to do? The point is you can't have diverse and diverging loyalties and be an Olympic athlete. As Jesus is going to Jerusalem, he's trying to get the same picture across to those who's following him. And that is, you can't have conflicting loyalties. You can only be loyal to Christ. I had a moment, and this was a very long time ago, so this probably was at least 20, maybe even 22, 23 years ago. I was at a campus ministry meeting at Marshall University. And we were in the process of putting together a campus ministry for Marshall. And they had a meeting of all of the campus ministers. And we were invited to introduce ourselves and just say a little something about yourself. And so you know, we're doing that whole who are we thing, you know. I'm John Smith. I'm the pastor at First Presbyterian Church. I'm, you know, Jane Johnson, and I'm the pastor at First United Church of Christ. Whatever it is that it might be the case, you know, I my turn came. I'm Russ Yoke. I'm the pastor at First Lutheran Church. Actually, at the time it was Christ Lutheran Church. But you know, as we went around, one of the last guys to actually do his introduction, he says, you know, my name is, I think it was Byron something or other, and I serve Christ in the role of pastor at such and such church. And I think we all felt like idiots at that point, because we're here, you know, planting our flag for our denomination, you know, in behind us like the UN. And we come to this guy who says, and I am a servant of Jesus Christ. Oh, and my service includes, I serve this congregation in this denomination. He had his priorities clear. He understood the notion that there's no such thing as a hyphenated Christian. And we need to hear those words from Jesus. We need to understand that divided loyalties are crooked rows, and a crooked row is not acceptable on the farm of the kingdom. And so we need to be reminded of this. We need to be reminded of this on a daily basis, because there's a billion things that want to claim our loyalty other than the gospel of Jesus Christ. Politics, culture, society, subcultures, you name it, there's a million things that want to lay claim on our identity. Identity is probably one of the hot topic political buttons of the 21st century. And Jesus's point here is you only have one identity, the follower of Christ. That's it. And more importantly, that's all you need. That's all any of us need. It is completeness. It is truth. It is grace. It is mercy. It is holiness. It is assurance. It is promise. It is hope. Everything else will always fall short. And every time that we attach one of those hyphenated phrases to our Christianity, we're including flaws in our Christianity. We're inviting contaminant into the purity of walking with Christ. Because there is a purity to walk with Christ that is above and beyond everything else. So I say to you all from afar, as I am in New Hampshire celebrating my nephew's wedding, hear Christ's call. Understand what it means to let the dead bury the dead. And hear that call from Christ to let the dead bury the dead as a call to not sorrow or sacrifice, but glory. To follow Christ and Christ alone is the greatest glory, the greatest hope, the greatest joy, and the greatest peace any human being can ever, ever experience. So thank you all. God bless, and I'll see you next week.